From awaytogarden.com and robinhoodradio.com, this is Away to Garden with Margaret Roach, your weekly invitation to dig in and grow.
One of the items on my to-do list for spring, get more vertically creative, meaning to use vines more often and in more inspired ways in the garden. Today's guest calls that vines off the trellis, meaning not just the expected use, but scrambling up into shrubs or into trees, cascading over walls, which, by the way, I can't believe I have never done in my garden, and even vines in containers. The key is which vine for which use, because, hint, planting a trumpet vine or wisteria in your climbing rosebush probably isn't a good matchup. I'm so glad to welcome back Dan Long to the program from Athens, Georgia, where he owns Brushwood Nursery, a.k.a. GardenVines.com. Dan's the person I know with the most vines, 300-something kinds overall in his collection the last time I asked, and more than 150 clematis alone. I suspect he has something for every possible use we can come up with. Welcome, Dan. Welcome back to the program.
Thanks for having me back, Margaret.
So glad to speak to you as ever. And you know, before we start on our topic of the day, one quick question I don't think I've ever asked you before. What are the most popular vines that you sell? Is it the clematis that's your most, like, your sort of best sellers? Is that what they are?
Overall, we are best known for our clematis, yes.
Okay.
With a very strong showing in the climbing roses and the passion flowers.
Okay. And then on the other, the yin to the yang or vice versa, of all the ones, you know, you probably have some beloved vines there that you don't sell many of them, but you'd never take them off the list. Like, what are the underappreciated ones that you wish more people would give a try to?
You know, since moving south, I've really become very enamored of the Trachylus spermum, genus that's the star jasmine and Asiatic jasmine, and they're not fully hardy in more northern climates, but
right.
They're really durable. The foliage is often very colorful, and the flowers are fragrant. I've really come to love them. As far as some other ones, one that comes up over and over and over again for me is Parthenocissus henryana. And that's a silver vein creeper, and it looks somewhat like our Virginia creeper, but it's far more restrained in growth, and it has beautiful silver veination on the foliage. It's really quite nice.
So that's a goodie, a lesser known and maybe lesser appreciated goodie, but it sounds like a star. Okay, I'm going to look it up. Thank you.
It's great. Beautiful foliage all summer long, colors up very nicely in fall, and it won't eat your Volkswagen over the weekend. It's much more restrained than our native Virginia creeper.
Oh, my. So since I've confessed in the introduction to never having grown a vine in cascading fashion, you know, even though I have, like, stone walls with planting beds behind them in my garden, but sort of shame on me, I've never, you know, done the cascading thing. Can we start by talking about some examples of, you know, maybe in your travels, great examples of that you've seen or what you'd recommend, or which vines do well with sort of trailing down as opposed to up?
Sure, yeah. When people have a wall, they think they need to plant at the base of it something that's going to cling to the stone like a ficus pumila or a bignonia or something, but plenty of vines will cascade just fine. Another one we're talking about foliage back there with the silver vein creeper, a one that I love for cascading is Rex begonia vine.
Oh.
It's cissus discolor, and the foliage is just outstanding. It's beautiful, and it's a plenty vigorous. It loves to fall off the side of something, either spilling out of a very large container or cascading over a wall. Very decorative, very easy to grow. Now, that one is a tropical.
Right.
So if you want to go for something that's going to live for many years in a temperate climate, you can think in terms of something simple would be Jasminum nudiflorum, which is very hardy, and that is sort of an arching shrub that will cascade down quite a few feet very nicely. It's going to go up, out, and down, so it's going to take a fair amount of space in the process, but it makes a really great background and blooms very early, and it is the hardiest jasmine.
And it's the flower color is
yellow.
Yeah, that's
very
what I
early
thought.
Blooming.
Yeah. Very early blooming. A friend of mine has it by his kind of front stoop, I would say. He's kind
uh-huh.
of, and you at that time of year, you know, early in the year, you come. It is early, yes.
Yes.
Yeah,
very early,
and you kind of come to the door, and it's like this effusion of this lovely yellow. It's not a bawdy yellow.
Right.
You know? Yeah, and it's just like, wow, how did you get that to happen? And of course, it's not a tough plant to make grow. I mean, it's not like some tender, you know, delicate little thing. It's a doer, yeah.
Right, right. Very easy, very hardy. Some folks mistake it for
broom or something.
Forsythia.
Oh, forsythia. Oh, yeah. Not my favorite plant. You know, I've seen climbing hydrangeas spilling over stone walls in sort of older estate type, you know, settings, like old fashioned kind of, just like I've seen them growing up, you know, walls and sides of houses. But I've seen climbing hydrangea used that way as well.
I remember being in Western Connecticut after seeing you at the that benefit sale.
Oh, Trade Secrets.
Yes.
Yes, 1 May many years ago. Yes.
Yes, and we were touring gardens afterwards, and there was a beautiful, beautiful climbing hydrangea that was cascading down over a stone wall section just below a deck. And it was actually, I think the owner said something about, it was a visual and auditory block to the pump mechanism for the little pond and the waterfall below it. So it in itself created a waterfall effect, and it was above a waterfall.
Interesting. Now, you started by mentioning one of my favorite vines of all, the Rex begonia vine. This is this discolor, and I always grow it on kind of in a big, big, big clay pot right near the door of my house when people come in on garden tours and so forth, and on a big tripod of three tall bamboo canes, and it makes sort of, you know, this teepee-shaped, big, beautiful thing. And it's well named, I think, because the foliage is that sort of stained glass window kind of red and green with maybe a little silvery of the fancy leaf begonias.
Yes,
but
and
the
stems and petioles are also very pretty.
Yeah, and it's like the little, it's a grape, yeah, Cissus, it's a grape, yes.
It's in that family,
yeah. Grape relative, and it has kind of like grapes do, the tendrily kind of, you know.
Yes.
Yeah, so they're like curlicues, what you're describing, and they're beautiful purple wine color. And you brought up that it's a tropical, and so everybody, of course, who comes in says, oh, how do you overwinter that? And I'm like, well, to tell you the truth, I don't really have a place for it, so I kind of throw it away, or I give it to somebody. Sometimes friends who have greenhouses or whatever adopt it at the end of the year, or a botanic garden does. You know, I take it out of the pot. I don't give them the pot.
Right. Right.
I'm a greedy guts. and you know, so, but sometimes I just discard it because it's worth it. It's an annual. For me, I use it as like an annual. And that's another thing I guess we want to bring up is it doesn't have to be a perennial thing to be used in these ways, right?
Oh, absolutely. And that's something that I see all the time. And I see folks, they'll buy flats and flats of annuals. And they're beautiful, and they fill a little space at the front of a border or something like that. When they could buy one of these single annual vines and cover a huge amount of space,
right?
And it makes an absolutely beautiful display all summer long,
right?
Either with just the foliage or often with flowers,
right?
So yeah, it doesn't have to be a perennial or deciduous vine or evergreen vine necessarily. It can be for you to enjoy for those 4 or 5 months of the growing season.
Right, and as you point out, even if it costs the same as a couple of flats of fill-in-the-blank annual, you know, it's still, you're going to discard those anyway, so it's okay.
Right, and your coverage, your,
right.
I don't know, call it your beauty quotient per dollar, I think they're a bargain.
Yeah. So I suppose the classic image of, you know, vine in a shrub to move to another sort of vines off the trellis idea is a clematis in a rose bush of some kind, like we see in English garden pictures all the time traditionally. So let's talk about how that works and also other ideas for shrub and vine pairings, because I expect you've seen some great examples of those as well.
I have a friend who lives south of Atlanta, and she has several hundred clematis, and I think she has something like 4 or 5 trellises. In her entire garden.
So she has hundreds of clematis and only four or five trellises.
Yes.
Okay.
It's a sight to see. It's really quite beautiful.
Wow.
And really, you know, these vines didn't evolve to grow onto a trellis. They evolved to grow onto other objects. You know, you've got the ones that self-cling onto a stone wall a stone outcropping or a tree or that sort of thing.
Right, a stone wall that nature built.
Right, exactly. Then clematis in particular evolved to grow onto other shrubs and small trees.
Mm-hmm.
And most of the hybrids retain that ability to climb. The nice thing about them is that most of them are very lightweight, and all of them climb and hold by wrapping their petiole onto other stems.
Right.
The petiole being the leaf stem.
Yeah.
And it's a very lightweight, non-damaging way to hold on to a host plant. And so it's not twining and growing and choking the host plant. It's just got a couple of fingers wrapped onto it.
Right.
And so once it gets a hold of that, it'll find more of the stems and it'll cling on to itself as it grows and branches out. And they tend to have a very lightweight structure. They're most of them. Now we should talk about pairing mature sizes here in a sec.
Yes.
But you also, in most cases, are going to prune those clematis back every year.
Mm-hmm.
And so there isn't a big, horrible buildup that's going to choke anything out.
Right.
They're really terrific. You grow them up into, say, a climbing rose where it can hold on to those big, heavy canes of the climbing rose. And you can do it a couple of different ways. You can grow a short one to grow on, say, maybe your climbing rose is really tall, 15 feet tall, and it over time gets some bare legs.
You can
cover up the bare legs with beautiful greenery and pretty flowers. Or you can grow a taller one that's going to match the height of the flowering portion of your climbing rose, and you can time the flowering so that you get a mix of colors in the same spot.
Yes. So you just sort of hinted at sort of a caveat about the pairings, and I'm imagining that, like, say, Clematis Montana is not a clematis I'm doing this with. Is that, you know, I'm thinking of that as like an example of one that I've seen get quite robust, maybe
right.
Too big for this purpose?
It depends on the host, and this is where you want
okay.
to do your pairing. You want to be thoughtful about it. Say, you know, is my Clematis Montana, is it going to mature at 30 feet, 40 feet? Does it have a thick, heavy canopy? What would be a suitable host plant for that? I have seen one trained beautifully into a tall pine tree at Chanticleer Garden. And they do a fantastic job. They live well together with each other. I believe in the case of that pine, they probably have to do some supplemental fertilizing and irrigation because the base of the clematis is inside the drip zone of the tree.
That's a dry place inside a conifer's drip line.
Right,
yeah.
Exactly. So they do some supplemental work in that case. But again, what they've done is they have paired the mature size of the vine with a suitable host.
Right, and so what I was sort of thinking is that Montana wouldn't be good in my rose bush.
Correct.
But it would be good, as you're pointing out, in something much larger scale. And then the one that would have climbed up the legs, the naked legs of my climbing rose bush, wouldn't be substantial enough for that pine tree. So I have to make a good match.
Right, right.
Okay.
Definitely look at the mature size. Go with a clematis, you know, up to 8 feet as a mature height if you want to fill the legs of something taller. Or if you have a shorter climbing rose, say, for example, Joseph's coat, which really doesn't max out, you can actually have it climb up in through all of that and bloom in multicolor with it.
I have to confess that I have them in some wacky things that probably aren't, you know, in the list of top shrubs to put them in, like, but that I think are kind of nondescript or even, you might say, ugly. Much of the season, like winterberry hollies. I have clematis in some of my winterberries. And, you know, winterberries are fantastic in the fall and into the winter when the fruit is ripe, but there's not much to be said about them earlier in the season. They're just nondescript shrubs with small green leaves.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
And that's an excellent way to grow them. You're extending the season of color,
right,
or the season of interest by adding that. It's the same thing with but going back to forsythia, it's very boring for all the rest of the year.
Yes.
And you can certainly train a little clematis up into one of those without harming it whatsoever.
So on a slightly bigger scale, and you were just talking about a clematis, a larger clematis in a tree like the pine tree at Chanticleer, other vines can go up into mature trees also. Like I have a friend with schizophragma?
It's uh-huh.
Going up the trunk. I think it's a very old maple, and it's quite beautiful because the foliage itself is beautiful. I think it's one that has a little bit of variegation. Is that possible?
Might be moonlight.
Yes, that's what it is.
That one has a real nice pewter interveinal sheen on the
That's what it
foliage.
Is.
It's very pretty. Yeah.
And so it's almost like he's used the trunk of the tree as the trellis.
Oh,
and
absolutely.
Yeah.
And those self-clinging vines evolved to grow right up into a tree.
Right.
And they look great together. And unlike a wisteria, they won't choke the tree.
Right. So a couple of other examples, or any other examples of besides the clematis, besides the schizophragma, any others that you want us to have a look at?
A crossvine is a really, really
crossvine.
Beautiful one. Yeah,
mm-hmm.
That's a Bignonia capreolata,
mm-hmm.
and it grows very well up the bark of a trunk of a tree.
Oh.
It's interesting. It has, its leaf is divided into two leaflets and a tendril out the center, and that tendril can clasp onto stems, or it can hold on stone or masonry, and it can also grab onto fissures in tree bark.
Oh.
It'll grow on anything, basically, from a wire straight up to a wall. And it's a very pretty vine.
How hardy?
I believe up to zone 5.
Wow.
From selections.
Okay,
yeah.
Now that's something I've never grown. Oh, okay, good. That's good for me to look into then.
Yeah, that's a really great choice. There are others in the climbing hydrangea family. There's a southern native called Decumaria barbara, and the wood vamp is the common name. I really like it because it's so much faster than Hydrangea petiolaris. The flowers aren't quite as ornamental, but the foliage has this glossy, beautiful, almost tropical look to it, and it grows very quickly.
Oh, interesting, because that is one thing about the climbing hydrangea. It is slow to establish.
Yes.
Boy,
yeah.
Sometimes I stand out there talking to it and say, now, come on, please, this year, will you please come on this year? I've been so patient with you, and like, one day it finally does, but not until it's good and ready, boy.
Right, absolutely.
Yeah. So in a phone conversation or an email or something between us some time ago, you said something that stuck in my head, which is that clematis can be grown on supports in pots and then overwintered that way, like depending on where you live, with a little or a lot of protection. Like they can become a permanent container plant, a perennial container plant, and then maybe, you know, rolled back out into place, like I'd have to put it away. You know, I store some shrubs, some almost hardy or even hardy shrubs that I grow in big pots. I store them in my barn over the winter just to keep them from ice damage and wind damage and stuff.
Sure.
Can some of these vines really be done that way?
And then, absolutely.
Yeah.
And you know, if you're talking a tropical climate, it's a whole lot easier. You don't have to worry about freezing. But obviously, anywhere in the temperate climate, you want to be careful for a couple of considerations. You want to size the container appropriately. I like to recommend, if you're actually going to leave them out, that you use very large containers. And they are very, very heavy containers.
Yes.
And if you can, a very light-colored container. The biggest killer is that freeze-thaw cycle.
Yes.
They warm up in the sun on a sunny day, and then they freeze at night. And over and over and over again, that's just so brutal on roots. But if you're gonna, if you want to take them in, yeah, certainly. Size appropriate, of course.
Yeah.
You want to. I recommend large containers always, but if you have to go with a smaller one, work with some of the more compact hybrids. It's a whole lot easier because you're not struggling in the summertime to keep them properly irrigated and fertilized.
Right.
Just, you know, if you've got a 2-gallon pot out there on your deck and a 20-foot tall clematis, you're going to be watering it 3 times a day.
Right. So The last several minutes, I've been looking at, you know, as always, I'm always going, I love your kind of plant finder on your website on gardenvines.com, and, you know, because it's so great to be able to see in one place like this whole world of vines and search for different attributes and so forth. But I've been noticing that you've been raving about a new group of clematis and called the Riverside Hybrids, I think. Is that right?
Oh, passion flowers.
I'm sorry. What am I saying? Passion flowers. Yes, of course. That's. I'm sorry. I'm hallucinating over here.
That's okay.
And so these Riverside Hybrid passiflores, what about them has gotten you so excited? I haven't grown many passion flowers in my life, so, you know, tell me. What.
Sure.
Yeah.
Sure. Well, a number of years ago, I met a gentleman who's a breeder outside of London. His name is Miles Irvine, and he has been hybridizing passiflora for like two decades and has done some really great work. And he is a self-professed vicious tosser. If anything doesn't come anywhere near to a high standard of performance, it goes on the compost pile.
Off with its head.
Right. So he's been selectively breeding very carefully for a long time, and has entrusted us to bring his hybrids to the United States. And we are working in conjunction with a company called Plant Haven to introduce them as the Riverside Hybrids. And we have the first six of them out now. What's really great about them is it's all about his breeding program. He wastes no time with inferior hybrids, and they're big. The flowers are 50% bigger. They last longer. Oh. There are more flowers per vine. The plants are vigorous. The foliage is healthy. I mean, they're just overall superior, and you can't really understand without seeing it in person. But if you take the difference between, say, a 4-inch diameter and a 6-inch diameter flower, you say, oh well, that's only a little bit bigger. But the impact that makes
Wow.
in the landscape is tremendous. It's twice as much surface area.
Wow, that's a big flower for a passiflora. Wow.
It is.
And
it
they're
really is.
So crazy looking, the flowers, anyway. They're so, you know, I hate to use the word exotic, but they're so exotic looking, aren't they?
Oh, they are. They're,
yeah.
they're quite lovely, and they draw butterflies and other native pollinators. They're wonderful plants.
So not the Riverside Hybrid Clematis, which Margaret tried to rename them, but the Riverside Hybrid Passiflores. Dan Long, I'm always so happy to speak to you and get excited about the vertical garden, or in some cases, the cascading garden, vertical upside down in this case. Thank you so much for joining me today.
Well, thanks for having me back. I really appreciate it.
Yes, and I'll talk to you soon again.
Thank you.
And I'll talk to all the rest of you soon again, I hope, too, like maybe next week. Now, don't miss an episode. You can subscribe free on Stitcher or iTunes to the podcast version. You can find me anytime at facebook.com/awaytogarden or at awaytogarden.com. And happy gardening. Meantime, start cleaning up, okay?
A Way to Garden with Margaret Roach is a joint production of awaytogarden.com and the smallest NPR station in the nation, Robin Hood Radio.